in Sao Paulo, the 8th of January of 1989. And we're in a house called what you have seen previously were some views of the city of Sao Paulo. And now you're seeing Paulo's home. And here is Paulo Freire, which we all owe so much. Paulo puede decir cualquier cosa. He's been taken totally handedly. Paulo, estás en la cámara. You want to say something to your friends in the United States?
Oh, yes, that is. We are very happy with your arrival here, both of you. I am especially very happy with the book we spoke together, and I think that it will become a good book. And finally, after 15 days training in Sao Paulo, I'm very happy also because today we can see the sun and the sky, not too much beautiful, but at least more or less nice. My greetings to all of my friends in the States.
I think all your friends in the States are very excited knowing about the development of your new position. Would you like to say something about that?
Yes, I am very challenged to be responsible for the education in such a city. It's more or less it's a kind of a state, you know, in Latin America or in Europe. It's very difficult. We found the Secretary of Education in a very, very bad situation, without money, without materials, with people almost despair, afraid. And it's not easy now to confront the two main deficiencies of the educational system. On the one hand, the lack of quantity of schools for the people. We have about 200,000 kids in the city of São Paulo without schools. On the other hand, also how to confront the duty we have to make the public school better. That is, we have to change the school. One of our dreams is to reinvent the public school in order to make it serious, but at the same time, a space for happiness. I will try with my colleagues.
And we all will.
We are now in Paulo Freire's studio, and Paulo has graciously accepted to dialogue about the topic of participatory research. Paulo, as you know, just as critical pedagogy is gaining a very strong momentum in the United States, and there is quite a bit of publications coming out on this topic, participatory research also has gained visibility, and I would say even more than that, it's gained some legitimization, so that now we find educational research being done using participatory research. And I, for example, as you know, at my university, at the University of San Francisco, most of my doctoral students are writing their dissertations using participatory research. So I think that it would be extremely interesting in the United States if both my students, of course, but people at other universities would have an opportunity to listen to you talking about participatory research, since most of these, their theoretical foundation all comes from your writing. So for their benefit, I'd like to invite you for some reflections on this. It is my personal experience, that every time that we talk about critical pedagogy, you remember it happened at Irvine, it always happened, people always say, well, why don't you model it? We want to see it in action. And of course it's always very difficult to do, yeah. Because it's something that one cannot create on a setting. It's something that comes from the work in action, right? But as I was talking to some of my students about the possibility of getting you to talk about participatory research, one of them, Connie Butel, suggested to me, she said it would be wonderful if you and Paolo would carry on a dialogue and then would stop and would listen to your own dialogue and reflect upon it and let us sort of see the model of reflection. So I don't know what you think about this
topic. Yeah, first of all, I think that it's interesting, you know. I don't see that I personally have many things to say beyond the things I already said, you know, in the States and here. But anyway, I think that always it's a good time for us to have a conversation. But I would ask you, before asking the questions to me, or for us to become engaged in the process of answering, I would like very much if you said something to me about how you work with these students.
Beautiful. I of course I'll be delighted to tell you this, since this is the core of my work and therefore the core of my life right now. Also because I realize that it's already somewhat different what we're doing. Participatory research, obviously, I think was initially conceived by you as something that would lead to community action, something that would be involving the participants or the learners into taking ownership of their own reality by studying it. And we're now doing it in an academic setting, and that's already one of the things that I would like to talk to you about, because it seems to be a certain contradiction on this, but I'm working on trying to resolve such contradiction. I want to tell you that when we started doing participatory research for dissertation, we were facing a great deal of antagonism from other people, because traditionally in the States there is a real believe in positivist type of thinking, and so the idea of a dialectical situation where you are proposing that the questions are going to grow out of the process, and you're not walking in just with a pure hypothesis that you're going to check through experiment, just seemed like it wasn't legitimate enough. But I have been very disturbed by how many people wrote dissertations that had no substance and no meaning and no contribution at all. Sure, they were beautiful exercises of empirical research, and so they got the people a degree, but they couldn't contribute to change or transform anything because the scope was so limited. In order to be able to create an experiment in education with human lives, you have to reduce the scope so much that at the end there is practically no substance to it. So the students that I work with are people that are really committed to social change. Mm. They're really people that want to see a transformation of reality. They're people that have a strong sense of social justice. And for them to go through an exercise like this and spend so much effort in doing a dissertation that would have no meaning was something that I thought very inappropriate. So there was even this reason to say, well, you are going to do a research, you're doing it with a population that you're interested on, why not do it in such a way that you will be guaranteed at least some true learning, because by going and talking to a community, which may be, in the case of my students, so that you know some of the areas that we work with, sometimes they have been populations that have been hardly not approached for research at all, like the Hmong community. This is a rural a community from Southeast Asia, transported onto the United States, who are there bewildered by this new reality, losing very rapidly their cultural values, and nobody had really gone and engaged them into reflecting on what was happening to them. Maybe sometimes we work with, let's say, illiterate people, people that have gone through the educational system but have not gained any knowledge from it, and on the contrary have been really much disturbed and distracted by the process. Or now I'm beginning to have students work with children and with young people, and asking these young people, what is learning for you? Mm-hmm. What is the schooling for you? What is happening? We're working, for example, with elderly people. I have a student who's doing her dissertation with women that are all between 76 and 82 years old. And these are Hispanic women that have lived and survived in the United States. And now this woman is asking them, you know, what have they learned in their process of living? And what does education mean to them? And what do they think of the future? And it's beautiful because these women have such a sense of future and such a sense of responsibility towards the future. And so the kind of research that we're basically doing is trying to get into the community, observe, talk, get some feeling about what may be some of the important themes for that community. Then elaborate some very major research questions openly, and then develop sort of a protocol of possible questions to initiate a dialogue, but always with the understanding that these questions might be reshaped in the process of the dialogue. Then the student goes into this community, identifies maybe 8 or 10 people, no more than that, because we want to do a real in-depth analysis with these people. And the student meets with the persons individually for a session maybe of 1.5 or 2 hours that gets recorded, posing these questions, and then goes back and transcribes the tape, creates a text with the tape, analyzes that text, looks for contradictions, looks for emergent themes, looks for things in there that could lead to further reflection, and then goes to the second person of the group, engages in the same dialogue, but this time the dialogue is not just between these two people, it's also between these two people and that other first person who gave some insight. So maybe some of the issues that came on the first conversation will become part of the second, and this way we move one time with every participant. Then the participants are given back their text, and this is something we want to talk about, because in sort of the pure form in which this research has been proposed, you would give the participant the text. Well, we have found early on that many of our participants are not ready to get a text that transcribes their speech,
yeah,
because the transcription of the speech is always arbitrary. In the speech, we use our hands, our voice, our gestures, we pause, we sometimes go back and forth, and when you put this on a paper, it looks very odd. And for example, we discovered that some of our participants were turned off by that. They began worrying about, oh, but this sentence is not complete, my syntax is all wrong. So they were feeling bad about the way their speech looked on the paper, and that disturbed them and distracted them from the essence and the substance. So one of the things that was learned that we needed to refine on this methodology is, what text do we give back? Sometimes we give a summary of the conversation. Sometimes we give only a few points. Sometimes we give the whole transcript. It depends on who the participants are, and also what they want and how they will react to what they get from us. Sometimes we play them back the tape. Mm-hmm. But one way or another, they get their own information back, and they get an opportunity to reflect again upon what they said before. And they also get the researcher to say, well, this is what I think you're trying to tell me. This is how I interpret it. Am I reading you right? And can we pose additional questions? And then with the richness of all the dialogue from all the other people, this discussion becomes a lot more substantive. Then the researcher takes all these texts back from the first and the second dialogue and analyzes it.
But how...
Tell me something about how the researchers go
into the community
and how do they start.
Okay. We consider this to be one of the essential parts, this entry into the community.
Yes.
How do we develop that right, if you would, to invite these people to participate? Well, it varies. In most instances, the researcher has already had some contact with the community. Maybe the researcher is a teacher and is going to invite former students to reflect upon educational process. Maybe in the case of the student Luke Jensen, who worked with the Hmong community. Well, this man was a teacher in a community college, and he taught French, but he taught a course on art, on ceramics. In one semester, he had two Hmong students. And he was very gentle to them, because Luke is a very gentle person, and these people, they didn't have a language to communicate with, but art became their language of communication, and he was kind to them. Next semester, he had like 14 Hmong students. The third semester, he had 60 Hmong students taking a ceramic course that have never had more than 4 or 5 students, but they were coming because they were finding a space of acceptance. And then Luke said, these people need an opportunity to be listened to dialogue. He began reading and studying about the Hmong. He identified people in the Hmong community that spoke English so that he could really dialogue with them. He speaks French, so he was able to identify some people that spoke French. He had a friend that is a priest that was preaching with him in the Hmong community. So he found all kinds of entries into the community this way. So when finally he invited the people to dialogue with him, they already respected him. Mm-hmm. They already knew that he was involved and concerned about this community. The student, Carol Wilson, who worked with the illiterate women, she directs a literacy campaign program. So she had the tutors propose to the women they were working with if there were any that was interested in participating in sharing their insights. So what we look for is people in the community that are willing to reflect, that are willing to share. It's a total voluntary participation, so it's not randomizing or anything like that. We don't assume that we're going to generalize from this dialogue to everyone, so we don't feel we have to go through any of those processes. We want people that really want to dialogue. In the case of, for example, I have a student who's done an incredibly beautiful study in Israel between Israelis and Palestinians that are friends. Israeli Jews, Palestinians that are friends, that have broken through the difficulties of the war situation they have there and hold very strong relationships of friendship. Well, she went to Israel first, she spent the whole summer, she met people, she met professors at the university who introduced her to some students that they suspected had these kinds of friendship. She met the people, she became friends with them, she corresponded during a whole year, then she went back for a whole summer, and everyone that talked to her did it because they knew about the study and they wanted to be a part. So I think that, yes, the entry into the community is a very delicate process and has to be, it takes time. It mm-hmm. cannot be improvised. You don't go with a microphone and say, I want to talk with you. No. Is this
answer
to what?
Yeah.
Okay. So in the process, then, we're at the process in which now we have a text, but we really have more than one text. In the process of refining the methodology, I have been insistent to the students that it's important that they keep first a diary, a journal of their own reflection.
Yes, of course.
So from the moment they begin this study, they are writing what is happening to them, what they think about these topics, these questions, and how their own thinking is being changed and challenged by what they're seeing, by each of the dialogues, by the way in which people have reacted, how they're, and we see extraordinary change in the in not only in what they knew about the topic and what now they know, but also about what they perceive of the group, what they thought the community was like. Even in spite of all that process of entry, now this community becomes a very different thing in their eyes as they reflect upon it daily. I'm also insisting on them to keep a second record. And the second record is a log or a notebook of the participation. So I suggest to them that as they're dialoguing, they make small notes of how the person, how the person acted, whether the person, there was any perceivable difference on how the person acted, but also where the dialogue took place, what were the conditions of the space and the time. And after they walk out of the dialogue, then they should in that log also note anything that was perceivable from the exchange that maybe is not going to be transmitted into the voice on the recording, so that when they listen to the tape to transcribe, they also read their notes, and then they can incorporate those observations into that text. So the text becomes a lot richer than just the words.
Yes, okay.
So now when they're analyzing, they have three things. They have their diary of reflections, they have the words of the participants, and they have those notes that get incorporated into the text. And so now they look for emergent themes. They, of course, have their own questions that they have posed, but what we find in Paulo, and this is one of the things that I wanted to share with you on the refinement of the methodology, is that sometimes the participants take ownership of the research by proposing and insisting upon other issues of questioning. For example, back to that research in Israel of Naomi. Mm-hmm. Naomi was concerned about friendship, human relationships. How do you manage to develop human relationships against your family beliefs, against your societal beliefs, against what your community is preaching of separation? How do people bridge over this? And she wanted to see what were the conditions that got people to do that. But her participants were really interested in talking about human rights in Israel. They were really concerned about issues of social justice in Israel. And that was in the background of what Naomi was doing, but it was not where she had thought she was zeroing. But her participants were very vocal, and so the research takes another dimension.
But it's very interesting in this case, no? I think that there is a very interesting point. I am not sure whether this point I will speak about has been captured by the researcher. This is she was thinking about friendship. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, during the process of the research, the participants insisted on the human rights. In my point of view, the question of friendship, which also was inserted in the beginning of the research of the meetings, no? For example, the possibility which both groups, no, the Palestinians and the Jews, were looking for, no, the possibility for being together, for overcoming the difficulties. Since the beginning, this dream was something very political and ideological. Mm-hmm. Then, it was not just a question, a strange question, no, of some people trying to make an exercise of friendship.
No.
They were, in my point of view, they were a sensitive. Friendship was
a political.
Yes.
Sure.
And friendship was a medium for getting
to the human rights and the
yes.
And Naomi knew that, and she was looking at it within that perspective. But the people wanted to talk about many other issues.
Oh, yes, yes.
And it was logical.
But it's logical.
And she was delighted, and so the research becomes a lot richer than they see. It, to a certain extent, the students try to focus the research because they are writing a dissertation, which is already a sort of a contrived exercise, and they know that they have just so much time and that they have to do something concrete. But sometimes it twists somehow, and it's interesting that the other study that where we have had something similar to this, the parallel, is great, and it's a very different study. This is Connie Butel is doing has just finished a study. She works for the Pacific Telephone Company, which is a very large corporation. They are the largest private employer in California, big corporation, and she directs a program by which all these workers could go to a university and get a university degree if they wanted to. But very few of them take advantage of this. Now, this is surprising because here is a unique situation. The corporation pays for the people to study, and yet few of the people take advantage of it. And she wanted to know, why do people don't take advantage of this? And is it that education really does not have a meaning to them, and if it doesn't, why doesn't it? Why, even though the corporation says, we want you to get a degree, and here is the money for you to get a degree, they don't do it. So is it that they have lost their faith in the education and in the value of education? Is it that the corporation, that they feel that the corporation is giving them a strange message? It says, yes, go and get a degree, but it doesn't really give them recognition for it. You know, what is happening there? And also, she was questioning if we could create critical pedagogy, if what the students would be getting would be education of a different sort, would this be meaningful to them? And so her questioning to the people were things that was fascinating, because she was telling me that when she started asking this question, she thought, well, this is crazy, because she was asking the people things like, what is knowledge? What is it to know?
Mm-hmm.
What it is to learn, you know, what is the process of education? And the people were delighted to have an opportunity to talk about these things. The people didn't feel frightened by questions like, what is knowledge? They knew what knowledge was, and they could reflect and talk about it, which was interesting, because many times people would think that those are too abstract questions, but that's not true. But what she found was, again, that even though her participants were interested in talking about education and did talk about education, they wanted to talk beyond education. They wanted to talk about, is it possible to be human within a corporate situation? How do we humanize the corporation? So, you see, Connie, again, was looking at education as a humanizing process, but her participants were not willing to stay just with the
class. Yes,
they wanted
course.
To talk about the major.
Yes, of course. No?
All right. So, so then the student then, on looking at the text, finds that sometimes the categories that the researcher had initially planned to use as an analysis of the data are valid no longer. That it's the emergent themes that have to become the categories of, you know, the categories of reflection. Then, in the ideal situation, the researcher writes out what has transpired from this dialogue and then hands that back to the participant.
Yeah.
So far, we haven't always been able to do that. Sometimes the participants were only able to read their transcripts of their second interview, but they never got to read the final study before it got presented. But now we're aiming to always doing that, to make sure that the The final stage is when, now that the researcher thinks that she or he has done all the analysis, that is taken back to the group. Sometimes we get the participants now not individually, but as a group.
Yeah.
And as a group, they hear, or and they get to discuss, this is what the researcher is going to say. Or it's given individually to them. And then they have a last opportunity, not a last, I mean, hopefully, and it's happening. Out of this research, the communication doesn't finish. On the contrary,
yeah.
The action begins to take place. It is research that is geared to action. And so once the people have been involved with the researcher in this way and reflecting, this is not going to stop. But the last, as to the dissertation, opportunity to come back and say, well, yes, you've quoted my words right, but what about, and still bring something else to the research at that time. So this is what we're basically doing. Does this give you enough of an idea?
Look, I think that there is a point which the researcher should have clear. And I think that all of them who are doing that have already this point clear. Is that if every kind of research has something to do with education, the methodology, this participatory methodology, makes the researcher a real educational activity.
Exactly.
And at the same time, this kind of approach ends up by revealing also that every kind of educational activity is also
research. Exactly.
Mm? And it's very interesting because if it was like this, yesterday or tomorrow, education always is research, and research always was education. The question is to know education, what kind of education, what kind of understanding about knowing. It's a question, it's another question. But the students who are engaged in this process of research like this, in my point of view, have to be very clear concerning this. For example, I would like to come back to the question of the research about the Palestine, the friendship.
Yes.
No? For example, one thing is for us, you and me, India, to talk between ourselves about friendship and about our friendship. One thing is to experience this kind of friendship at this level of our particular friendship. We are experiencing something very beautiful from the point of view of the human existence. At the case of at the level of the case of the research, the friendship is something more than that. That is, the friendship is also an imperative. And it becomes a kind of instrument, political instrument, to demonstrate that it is possible.
Exactly.
For example, I am not interested in you and Ian to demonstrate the world that it's possible to love. We just love ourselves. Then, I don't want to say to you that in all the moments of our experience of friendship, we are neutral beings. No, we are not. But what I want to say is that our friendship, the relationships between us, at least at this level of our lives, these relationships are not becoming, and they are not, they don't need to become instruments for changing San Francisco or São Paulo. But in that case, yes. Mm-hmm. Then for me, and maybe even the
and
very
Paulo, but even they do, because the fact that you extend this friendship to me gives a credibility to my words in that university. It would not have been possible to do participatory research if you had not offered your friendship to me.
Yeah, but so it is a consequence of it. Yes. It is a consequence of the old relationships. I am sure, Alma, that the things which happen in the world have consequences. Mm-hmm. Many times we don't see. We are not able to see.
Sure. Mm. But they do. But I know what you were saying.
Do you see? Then I think that,
yes, that in their case, that friendship is a political action of great strength. And this is why the research was important. And
this is why
Naomi was looking at that, because she wanted to come back to the United States and say to the people, look, it is possible to break through all that hate and separation and so forth, and human beings can take a stand individually in this case, but with a social mind. The same thing that we were saying yesterday, that the revolutionary action has to be the union of a number of individual actions too.
Yeah.
I mean, you cannot be socially conscious and individually callous. And it's not enough to be individually enlightened. You have to be individually enlightened to socially unite in action. But in this case, these people, each of whom has different degrees of participation of political action, they all have a clear notion that by that friendship they are making
a statement. For example, this research can reveal to the participants and to the researcher, since the beginning of the research and the before the beginning of the research, the research today can reveal to all of the participants this is so clearly this political connotation, and this political connotation can then begin to challenge the participants in order, precisely because they understood that, in order to go beyond, and in this way the research becomes education.
Definitely.
No? Definitely. And in becoming education, the education begins to provoke, to demand more research.
Exactly.
No?
Exactly.
It's a dynamic.
This is why it seemed just a natural thing that if you're talking about critical pedagogy as a way of education, that you want to do participatory research, and that the two things are one and the same thing.
Yeah.
Talking about the methodology in concrete, just to show you how much we've learned, I think by now, Paulo, I've directed about 12 or 13 of these studies. And from each one, we've learned something to make the methodology stronger and richer for the next. The first thing that we learned was that you cannot transcribe people's voices and give it to them and expect that everyone can deal with that. So we have to recognize that the transcription of the text becomes in itself, again, a pedagogical act.
Yes, of course.
As the researcher, you have to mediate and know how to extract and how to return to the person's voice. It's not just to give a transcript. Okay? So even though this is the way some people say it has to be done, we have learned that it's not that. That the researcher is a mediator and has to... Yes.
Yeah. At this moment, I would like to ask a question to you concerning this methodology and concerning getting back
the text.
No, we know that that really writing, first of all, from the humanity historical point of view, it took thousands of years.
Before getting
to
writing.
Yeah.
And wonderful things that
yes,
you did before.
No. But I think that no doubt about the role of writing, no, is a moment of not properly of structuring, because we are structured mm-hmm. at the moment in which we speak, mm-hmm. we begin to. But to help and to increase and mm-hmm. to improve mm-hmm. our the structures which make possible for us to speak. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. My question is whether, it's just a question, a curiosity, whether instead of giving back mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. the text transcribed, mm-hmm. or instead of not giving, to propose to the participants the exercise of editing mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. their own texts. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then they will have, vis-a-vis themselves, their speech, the oral speech. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which is very important for them to read how they spoke. Mm-hmm. No? And afterwards, they begin to work on, they discover the difference between writing and speaking. No? The demands which writing poses on us. And then they will try to work on.
Mm-hmm. I think that would definitely enrich the process enormously, and I'm going to consider this and propose this. We might not be able to do it in every.
Oh no! Yes. I think that
there might be some instances.
For example, with the illiterate people, you could not do that.
Could not do it, and
unless you just discuss it with them, it takes time. And,
exactly, yeah. and with your own children, but. You maybe couldn't do it, and in a situation like Israel, there would not have been probably time to do that. But we will find someone who wants to do a study where this is a part of that, because I think that's very important. I really think it's very important. It connects so much to what Madalena was saying about her methodology to a formation of the teachers yesterday that involves precisely.
Yes, of course, I say, yeah.
Thank you for that suggestion. I think it's beautiful. Another thing that we learn in the process had to do with the environment. Remember how we talked so much, Madalena and I, about how we need to create the physical environment that facilitates the learning process. The same with this. We found, for example, Luke Jensen found that when he brought the Hmong people to his house, the dialogue died. The people were impressed by looking at his environment, trying to understand him through his house and his environment, and then they weren't willing to share. So that for this, it works much better to go into the participant's home or the participant's community and do the research in their space, or to find a common space. I don't like to say a neutral space, because it's not a word that I give any validity to, but maybe the school setting or some place that was common to the two. Joyce Watts, for example, working with black parents in Los Angeles, realized that the dialogue got transformed enormously when she introduced the element of food. She would go to the people's house, but tell them that she was going to bring food. And so she brought food, and then she let them set it up. She brought food that was ready to eat, but she let the person in the house take mm-hmm. control of setting it up so that it became a real sharing situation. She brought the food, but the person in the house acted as the host by setting it up and serving it and so forth. And then that became already such a linkage of sharing that she found that her dialogue increase and enrich a great deal. In other instances when the people were not ready to do it this way, she invited them to a restaurant, to a quiet type of restaurant, and they ate first. And she, in her time, she always allowed herself 3 hours, and they spent like a whole hour eating and talking about personal things, and then got into the dialogue, mm-hmm. and that was important. One thing that, for example, we've been refining is we want the participants to have as much ownership that, you know, the traditional anthropological research with which this connects very much says, well, you have to change the people's names to protect their identity. But some, now we've began to say, well, let's tell the participants and let the participants be the one choosing the name they want to be identified
yeah,
by.
Yeah, yes, okay.
This is a minor detail, but I think it's a very important
yes,
detail.
Yes, of course.
Because of the importance of the name.
Yeah.
It was a kind of a absurdity that here we were taking these people's very deep feelings and reflections, and then on representing it in order to protect their identity, we give them X name.
Yeah, Shakespeare.
Yeah. No sense. So, for example, in a research done with children, I mean, with these are young people, wonderful, beautiful, you'd love this research, I'll tell you about it, I'll tell you later, but this is a woman who was the teacher of these kids, and now 4 years later, she went and talked to them, and she gave them the option, and they say, well, keep our first name and give us a different last name. So they wanted at least that in the research, their first name will be theirs, and then together they chose a last name. But there is all women, these Hispanic women that are all between 76 and 82 or something, they said, we want our names. You're not going to give us any funny names. You don't need to protect that identity. And the researcher was very surprised, Greta Glugowski was very surprised, because some of these women had shared very hard things, okay? Having been abused, having been, you know, violated by relatives. I mean, some real terrible things. And she thought these would precisely be people that wouldn't want their name there. But
yeah,
these women said, no, this is our life, and we are not going to give you our life with another name.
Yeah,
you put it with our name.
It's beautiful. So
I think it's beautiful, of course. I think it's absolutely beautiful. So now we...
And I think that this is the first time that I hear researchers, and I know about discussing with the participants the possibility of changing their names and the reason why.
Exactly.
It is fantastic.
Exactly. Right? Yes, this is why I'm telling you that this methodology in just these many studies has grown and become so very refined. I mean, and it will continue growing.
Yeah.
I mean, in each study we do new things, but we learn from each other.
Because look, it's a kind of the rebirth, no?
Yeah.
Because the participant has the right to choose the other name,
yes.
you know, with
yes.
which he or she appears
yes.
publicly.
Yes.
No, it is beautiful.
Yes. Well, I think so, Paolo. We feel this is absolutely very important. But there are a few questions. I don't know if you want to, now that I've talked...
No, yes, no. Let us.
Okay. There are a few questions that I wanted to ask you. And the first one was that because the people doing this are extremely ethical people, we have posed the question in our research seminars of, here, to what extent is there not an inner contradiction that we are going to the participants and yes, we are respecting them and we're listening to their voice and we are giving their voices a projection that normally their voices would not have had of becoming part of a book, of a dissertation, of now being exposed. But when you look at the, if we would say it, at the gain, if we can use this word, of the research. Here the researcher is gaining a doctorate. The researcher is really perhaps receiving more than the participant. And this worries us to some extent, and we don't know what you would say about this sort of connection here.
Look, first of all, I think that we have to recognize that it is a very concrete situation. That is, the researcher could not, through his or her research, change the world between Monday and Tuesday. No? And secondly, for example, since the research is respecting and has a certain ethics and respects the participants, I think that, for example, one of the issues the researcher should talk about is precisely this one. Mm-hmm. To make clear that the way society has been organized and still is, generates power. Mm-hmm. Power cannot, that the society cannot exist without power. The question is to know who has the power and in favor of what, mm-hmm, and against the whom. Mm-hmm. This is the question. Then, I think that it is easy for the people to understand that if at the moment of the research the people did not get yet, for any reasons, more presence, mm-hmm, in the world, mm-hmm, this kind of research contributes to say that the people don't have voice. And then it is politically important. If, for example, I know that lots, thousands, millions of people in my country cannot live in a house like this, mm-hmm, cannot have this kind of study, mm-hmm, cannot have the books I have, could not write the books I could write. It should be very naive from my part if, because of that, I felt guilt, mm-hmm, full of culpability, mm-hmm, and then tomorrow I left this house and I went to live in the periphery of the city to cry as the demonstration of my love to the people. No. I think, I'm sure, I have to stay here. It is also the result of my action. Mm-hmm. And in being here, I got some power. Mm-hmm. And I came here because of this power. It's very, mm-hmm, dialectical. And then the books I write have something to do with the transformation of the world. What I want, my dream is that in a certain moment of the life of my country, the distance between men like me and the masses of the people is diminished. I am not responsible directly, mm-hmm, of that. This is, yes, for me the, yes, same, yes, thing.
It's absolutely the same thing, but it's going to be very rewarding for our students to hear you say this, Paolo. So thank you very much for having said that, because I think we've debated and almost arrived to the same conclusions, but we want.
And there is another aspect is that, until recently, mm-hmm, the universities did not respect this kind of, yes, of approach.
Yes.
No? And now many universities began to understand that there are different ways of making science. Mm-hmm. No? And this is one. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No? And it is important then that the students continue to do that. The question is to know whether in the process of doing that the students lose themselves, mm-hmm, attracted
attraídos, mm-hmm, attracted,
attracted by, yeah, by other kind of dreams. In the last analysis, the question is to know whether the people doing that preserve their integrity.
That has not been a case. I've been very fortunate. The people that I've been working with are just extraordinary. I mean, my students are the most extraordinary people. And some actions, some consequences, some direct consequences of this research have taken place. First of all, in every case, the participants have felt more empowered.
They have felt that
they understand their reality now in a different way. They have felt less isolated. They have felt, you know, great expectations for the research. In some cases, for example, in the case of these old women, they are after the researcher. They're calling her and saying, when are you writing it? We want to read it. Where is it? Where is our dissertation? You know, so they get a sense of ownership of the study. But besides that, for example, in the case of Luke, working with a monk, well, the number of things that came out of that. See, what he focused his study was, what are the values that the monk considered that are so important for them that they want to preserve in the United States? Are there any values that they feel are so in contradiction with the United States society that they want to negotiate mm-hmm. and change and modify? Okay, for example, certain values of not participating in class, of being extremely humble, of never asking a question, and things like that. Well, is it a value that can be reanalyzed in such a way that at some point a monk student can express his opinion in a classroom because in this society this is necessary and so forth? Okay. But things that have happened, for example, after doing this study, Luke discovered things like this. For many monks, they have never become literate in their own language. And it was important that they become literate in their own language if their culture is going to have a stronger hold in the United States. So he was able to get the college that he teaches at for the first time to offer courses in Hmong for Hmong people to be able to become literate in their language.
Yeah.
Now, the whole philosophy is these people have to learn English. Who cares about Hmong? Well, he was able to get this university to say, no, we are going to teach these people to learn and write, to read and write their own language. Okay. They began collecting folklore and traditions and cultural things in Hmong for these Hmong people. But his study developed so much interest in the college because he was dialoguing not only with the Hmong, but then he was dialoguing with the American professors and with the American students to see what they thought of the Hmong and where they found the conflicts, that he was able to start a course of Hmong for Americans. So then here are English-speaking people taking classes of Hmong. Then he was able to go to the University of California system and say, well, you demand 2 years of foreign studies for a student to enter the University System of California. What about accepting Hmong? Hmong? That has never been a legitimate language to be accepted by the University of California. They would accept German, French, Italian, Spanish, but Hmong, well, now they accept Hmong. So the Hmong students that meet all the other requirements and already have a foreign language to them because they have English and Hmong can enter the university without having to learn like another language, which would be, of course, a big burden for them to go into the university. Luke was able to get a big grant from the National Endowment for the Arts to do a research on collecting Hmong music.
Mm-hmm.
And so you see a number of things are happening to that community now that are the result of having gotten together to reflect upon what their situation was in the United States. So, this element of action is linked to this. Naomi came back to Israel and she was chairing a group in San Francisco that was demanding the recognition of a Palestinian state
mm-hmm.
during the recent American election. So, there's a lot of things that are happening as a result of this, but maybe just the fact that that the people have an opportunity to reflect, that they discover their own reality under a new light, that their voice is being projected, and that the fact that their voice has to be projected by someone else is, as you say, a very clear statement that these people have been robbed of their opportunity to speak their own word. I mean, it's a legitimization. But you mentioned this issue of this research becoming legitimized just recently, and Paolo, it is still an issue. There is still people that would say, well, 80% of the educational research in the United States is quantitative and is statistical, and doesn't that prove that, you know, that's the kind of research to do? And the students still feel under a lot of pressure that maybe this is not a totally legitimate research. And I wonder if you could speak to that issue. What are really the reasons for this defense of a positivist object?
Well, first of all, I think that we should understand that the numbers, the figures, the statistics alone don't speak about reality. Mm-hmm. In other words, reality is something more dynamic, more alive, more contradictory. And in being such a dynamic thing or event, reality, even though does not reject numerification, mm-hmm. Quantification, reality cannot accept being collapsed into quantification. No? I think that sometimes we lose the meaning of this. Mm-hmm. No? And then we cannot be dialectical. Mm-hmm. No? That is, we think mathematically, mm-hmm. but distorting mathematics. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No? Because we also cannot reduce mathematics into something static. Mm-hmm. No, it is not. Then, but on the other hand, in my point of view, when we don't accept the reduction, the learning, or the language for reading reality being reduced exactly just into quantification, we also don't have to deny some quantification, no? Because it is important, mm-hmm. no?
Definitely.
My impression is that the social science thought, if I can use this kind of speech, that the only way they had to become, to get dignity, mm-hmm. should be to follow the other sciences.
Exactly.
No? And, for example, it's very interesting that in Brazil we speak about, for example, science, and when we speak about science we are speaking about physics, biology, and so on. But when we speak about the social dimension, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. instead of speaking about social science, for example, mm-hmm. we have the tendency to speak about social studies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
No, and for example, at the curriculum of the primary school, the people speak about social studies, mm-hmm. and not the social science.
Right.
No?
The same thing happens in the United States.
And there is a certain difficulty to understand the study, mm-hmm. the knowing, mm-hmm. of society as something which is really science. And it is. Okay. Just different.
Exactly. No? Of course.
Just different. And because of that, I think the more we can be serious, this is the question,
yes,
that is
rigorous,
because, for example, we cannot deny, we cannot attack positivism because it is not serious and rigorous. Mm-hmm. It is also. Mm-hmm. No?
Oh, yes.
That is, we must be rigorous.
Oh, definitely.
No? Serious. Because we must approach the concrete object of our research in a very serious way, in order for us to be able to get a validity in the findings. Which we can get, no? But I remember that 4 years ago, I was invited to go to Los Angeles for the first meeting sponsored by the American Association of Sociology.
Mm-hmm.
No, during 4 days, I think, at the LA University.
UCLA,
yeah. 4 or 5 days discussing a participatory research.
Mm-hmm.
We had a small group of sociologists, American sociologists, but very interesting. The people, very good people. Peter Park was there. No? And it was a very good and important meeting. A small group, 30 people, maybe less than 30. But it was the first meeting. No? And my impression, this is the same in Brazil, my impression is that little by little,
mm-hmm.
we begin to change this understanding of knowing.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the last analysis, theory of knowledge and epistemology are involved in this.
Oh, yes.
No?
Oh, yes.
And for me, the question is to be more and more efficient, mm-hmm. serious, rigorous, and to go on.
You also had a discussion on participatory research at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst that resulted in a little booklet. I love the title, Dialogue is Not a Chat.
Yes.
And one of the issues posed there was the reluctance of some participants to involve on critical reflection. And we haven't had much of that problem, but it's still one of the things that comes about, especially when the researchers are beginning to do this study. Do you want to talk a little bit about the fear of knowing, about what this fear that may be part of the participants' reluctance?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it has to do, I think, with the dominant ideology. No, and the also that is, it has to do with the power of ideology and the ideology of power. No? Fear, it is one of the expressions of the fear of freedom. No? Erich Fromm studied so well. And in some moments, for example, I have been asked about the ethical dimension of this this problem.
Yes, no? I was going to ask you that too.
Yeah, if for example, we have the right, no?
To probe.
To challenge that. Look, I think that we have the duty, no? Let me try to discuss with a possible concrete example.
Very good.
No? Let us suppose, for example, that we come into
yes.
into an area, mm-hmm. a community. For different reasons, we came, and we were invited. No matter the way, mm-hmm. we arrived there, and we began to work with a group of 20 people, for example, some women and some men together. And then suddenly we think that it should be interesting and important to start a process of participatory research, because we also think to go on in developing a certain program of education. And then in a certain moment of our work with the people, they reject to understand themselves as dominated, exploited people, for example. In the last analysis, they are afraid, no? They are afraid of discovering, no? The raison d'être for some aspects of their existence. And then they prefer to be silent. And they prefer not to understand. They prefer to say goodbye to that question and to go on. They prefer not to be. Instead of accepting being as a struggle, they prefer not to be in passivity. Then now the question, someone comes and asks us a question from the point of view of ethics. Mm-hmm. And the question should be, do you really think that you have the right to continue to challenge the people in order for the people in thinking more critically than now mm-hmm. to unveil mm-hmm. their reality and then to say to themselves, okay, right now I know that I was afraid of being, and now even though I discovered that it is not easy for me to begin to be, it's better. It's better to know that I can't be as I should be than to lie to myself. My answer is that it's a duty. If I really understand the human beings like this, if I understand the human beings as a project and not as a certain immobilization in the world, mm-hmm. no, because it's not exclusively a question of believing, it's a question of recognizing that is, I know by analyzing myself, mm-hmm. I know that I am not in the world just to look at, but I am here, and it was possible for me to be here because before me, in millions of years, other human beings became human beings because they became able mm-hmm. to change the reality. Then it's for me a duty, unless I think that the human beings are not able, just a few people chosen mm-hmm. by God, uh-huh. no, or by other entity. These few people come to the world with the task of commanding. I don't believe in that. It's not science. It is pure ideology, the right. dominant ideology. Then, if I love the people with the power with which I love, my duty is to say, my friend, maybe you will cry But you are in a position in which many years ago you should start crying in order to get indignation. Mm-hmm. And now it's time for you to cry and afterwards to prepare yourself to have your delegitimation of being angry. Your destiny is not this one. Do you see? I think that this is the ethical position. Yes. But I would say something more in order to finish this question. Of course, it does not authorize us to go beyond the limits which history poses to you and to me, and social conditions. We don't have, and let me be very practical, it does not give me, recognizing that I have the duty to challenge the human beings to assume the power of thinking critically, does not allow me to become crazy, politically speaking, and then to lead the people, or masses of people, to do impossible things, and then to die.
Right.
No? I think that the ethical question which exists really in this issue has to do with the duty I have as a leader, as an educator, to recognize the limits for the action. I cannot say to a group of peasants, for example, in northeast Brazil, in discussing with them that they are being exploited, mm-hmm. No, terribly exploited. I don't have the duty at the moment in which they begin to think and to discover, mm-hmm. but they are still naive, mm-hmm. and maybe they look at me and they say, "Let's go now for the struggle." Right. I don't have the right to say, "Yes, let's go," because we will be killed.
Right.
No? But if you are able, if you have a competency, no, to show the limits, mm-hmm. of the action, the impossibility.
Yes.
No critical reflection without this possibility of understanding the limits.
Exactly.
Do you see? Then this is my position.
Exactly. That was just beautifully said, Paulo, and I think very inspiring to all of us. Now, sometimes the resistance to the dialogue comes not from the people, but from those in control.
Yeah.
And this, of course, is manifested in a number of ways. And I know you already addressed this on that conversation in Amherst, but I would like to impose on you and ask you to talk about it now. Where does that come from? For example, part of the resistance to legitimize this kind of research,
yeah.
for you to analyze where that comes from.
Yeah, it is. Look, I think that no matter the possible origin for that, we always will find some ideological reasons for that, you know? And because of that, sometimes the person, for example, who rejects that gives false reasons, mm-hmm. for denying, for example, the role of dialogue. Like, for example, if you dialogue with the participants of the research, you are destroying. This is not the
challenging.
No, you are distorting the results of the research,
for example.
Then you are no longer scientist.
Right.
No?
Right.
You lose the objectivity.
Exactly.
No? Because of the interference.
Uh-huh.
No?
Interference.
In the process, the interference of the participant, whose life should be researched by us.
Uh-huh.
No?
Right.
And do you see, I think that it is not exclusively scientific. Well, it is a scientific explanation, but a scientific explanation which is wept by ideology.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. No? And the ideology here is the ideology of the elitism.
No, exactly.
That is, the people are not able to know.
Exactly.
No, and
exactly.
We are able because exactly. The academy made us able
exactly.
to do that. Look, I don't deny that the academy has a fantastic role in that,
mm-hmm.
but it depends on the ideology we are leading with, no, in order to legitimate or not the presence of the people. Another possible reason for that is, this one is very strong.
It is very strong. Let me tell you one example. One of the students is a high school teacher, and she has students that she taught 2-3 years ago. These were students that arrived to the United States knowing no English. And then she, now that they have been there like 3 years and they can talk, she wants them to tell her, what was their immigrant experience? How did they feel? Like, you know, coming in from Nicaragua into an American classroom. And what happened to them in their process of learning English? How did they learn it? What things helped them? What things didn't help them? What things did the teacher do that contributed to them to feel capable of learning, and which things impeded their learning? And part of her research is, what recommendations would you have for teachers? Well, some of her professors, you know, at the university, how can they know? How are they going to tell the teachers what to do? I mean, these are students. Students cannot have any recommendation for teachers. How do they know? And it's this total lack of respect for all subjects' ability,
yeah.
regardless of their age or of their social class, of knowing.
Yeah.
And, of course, we think that the opposite is true, and you should see some of the things the students said were so intelligent and clear about their own process of learning and about what teachers could have done, you know. And it was interesting that a lot of it has to do with, they said, if the teachers would have ever paid any attention of trying to learn who we are, if any teacher ever would have tried to know who I am as a person, I would have been able to know.
Yes,
more.
Yes, yes.
You know, I mean, this is the same thing you or I would say. But this is a 13, 14-year-old can also say that because she's experienced.
Yes, yes.
Okay, so yes, this is a very clear idea of this elitist thing that we control knowledge because we have been accredited by academia and the rest have not.
Do you see
other reasons behind this?
I also think that sometimes, for example, besides this arrogance, you know, people are afraid of people. That is the some intellectuals get fear, you know, of people. That is they are not they would like very much to immobilize, you know, the people. Transforming them into a mere object.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of a table of stone, which I analyze. It's better not to provoke, to challenge the people to speak, no, but to analyze the people from very far from,
right,
no, with distance. Because it is as if the speech of the people were able to destroy the purity of their science. Then no contact.
Right. And we have to be very careful here to clarify that we also create distanciation in order to analyze that. When the student takes that text and, you know, and rereads it, that researcher is trying to also put a distance of both time and space there to, you know, to reanalyze this data with rigor.
Yeah.
But there is a difference,
yes,
between the inner distanciation is not, yes, there, right? With the
this is the question, no? Yeah. Well, of course, epistemologically speaking, from the theory point of view, of knowledge point of view, we really get distance from the object in order to objectifying it, and then to get it into the hands and to begin to analyze it, to know it.
Right.
Okay, but the question is that this is an operation of the mind, of the critical mind, in order to make abstraction. Mm-hmm. No, mm-hmm. In order to get the concreteness, I have to make to abstraction of it.
Right.
No, but this distance is not a social distance.
Exactly, it's not a human distance. Right.
No, this is the question, and there is a confusion sometimes, which is ideological.
Right. Paulo, I'm going to be arrogant now, but I think also that in a certain way, this type of research is a lot harder, more difficult, much more difficult to do.
I agree.
I mean, you do a survey and you create the questions, you send it out, people mark 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you put it through a formula, you get numbers back. That's a lot easier to do than, because many times people tell me, but yes, and then once you're going to get all those recordings and all that text, what are you going to do with it?
Yeah.
Are you going to count how many times the people use the word freedom to say that that's an emergent theme? That's not the way to know whether that's an emergent theme.
Yes, it
maybe
is.
Maybe it was mentioned once, but I mean, it's the context, it's the passion, it's the emotion, it's the strength, it's what it was said that gives it. But you have to really read carefully. You have to search. I mean, you have to listen. It's not
easy.
To be one of the things that the students have told me that they find was difficult was to engage in the dialogue and listen. And while the person was telling, for example, all these, especially in situations of oppression like we're dealing with, the difficulty to stay there and not to let the mind kind of jump into what are we going to do to not allow these things to happen, or dealing with the pain that it brings about when you hear things of injustice like this, or dealing with the situation that it's difficult to say something maybe at the time, and then the beauty of having it recorded and being able to go back and reread this and realize I should have been able to do more for the person then. I should have been able to respond better to this person, but I have the opportunity now. I can go back to the person and say, look, when you were saying this to me, it was so overwhelming to hear what you went through that I wasn't able to say much. That maybe I felt part of the group of people that have done these things to you. Maybe I felt like, you know, but now I come back to you and I tell you, your words have made me think and your words have made me reflect. And so you see the tremendous amount of compromiso, no?
That
then gets generated in this kind of research. So part of not wanting to deal with it is also fear, I think, of both the complexity of it.
Yes, okay? I agree with you. It's easier.
People say, well, they try to pretend that students that do this kind of research are looking for an easy way, because see, the mathematics are supposed to be hard and the statistics are supposed to be hard, and by the way, they make it look harder than it is, just to keep that sense of power that comes from I know something that is hard. And they put down this kind of research and they say, well, that's soft research as opposed to hard research.
Yes, yes.
And that's easy research. And it's not
easy. Not easy, not easy.
It's not. It's very demanding.
Very.
Okay. I wanted to see what you thought about that. Now, I think maybe I have just one last question, Paolo, that I'd like to maybe for you to talk about. And it's just in general terms. If we could talk about the role of research and how, you know, and the researcher, and how do we demystify this thing that we're saying? How I find that, yes, academia has given us much, but it has also done it with an elitist attitude of monopoly and control, of only we have a right to be researcher. And only we have a right to know and to do research. And so the students doing participatory research have constantly to be unlearning some of these things that they have been told so much. And maybe on closing you want to say something about this, or maybe you want to speak more. I don't know. You said there were certain things that you have not said yet about participatory research. Maybe you want to talk about.
No, I really don't. I think that I have said everything I think about that. No, I just would say that, and I am in agreement with you that it is not easy to be done, but it is important to be done. That is, we have to have the courage of reinventing things and the methods and the above all in order for us to give a contribution to the creation of a different world. And I think that making research respecting the expectations of the people, the dreams of the people, the fears of the people, learning from that, from the fears, discovering with the people the raison d'etre for the fears. The fears don't fall from the heaven, mm-hmm. as well as the hope. All these things happen in history, in society. They have reasons for their existence. And it is very important for us to know why I can have hope, and for what? Hope is not a saint, mm-hmm. a saint feeling. Mm-hmm. Hope and the lack of hope have to do with concrete and social and historical situations. And before being a condition for struggle, hope is the result of some atmosphere. Mm-hmm. No? But in being the result of some atmosphere, political atmosphere, social atmosphere, hope becomes an instrument for struggle. Then I think that all these things should be studied seriously, mm-hmm. by the participatory researchers, and the people who, with whom they work. Then my last words to them are words of hope, and I have reasons to have hope, the main reason for me to have hope is the conviction that the future is not something which is waiting for us, but on the contrary is some time which we have to build today by the construction, the changing of the world. And thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Paolo, for those words of hope. We are together constructing that world.
No, un regalo, no, no, un regalo.
No,
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 no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no,
em Brasília?
Não.
Quando o Lourinho se Pelé, passa isso e rompe na
não se ama.
Não se ama mais.
Nico,
faz o seguinte: $1 é igual a 1,60 francos. Matemática.
Ah, sim, é matemática, é o melhor.
Agora, $1,225, quantos francos serão?
Cross the street without walking, without seeing the perspective of this way.
Thank you so much, Rudy. Wonderful to have this memory of you now and say.